Wake up! Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You are now listening to UMES 30. I am your host, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. I realize that you could be anywhere in the world right now, but you're here listening with me, and I sincerely appreciate that. UMES 30 is a new talk show airing on Sunday mornings at 10:30. I'll be bringing you lively, thought-provoking discussions on a variety of topics. Each show will feature an extended conversation with a guest. While many of these individuals will come from UMES, the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, as well as the local community, I will also feature several guests from around the country. So without further ado, let's get started. As a teenager, I attended and ran track at DeMatha Catholic High School in Hyattsville, Maryland, which is nationally known for its sports program. It was during my time at DeMatha that I learned the term student athlete. Here's a quick history lesson of this term. Back in the 1950s, college athletes began filing for workers' compensation and benefits because they were not only being injured on the playing field, but some were even dying. Most college programs were scared of the idea of players being treated like state employees at the time. Some argue that Walter Byers, the first executive director of the National Collegiate Athletic Association, or the NCAA, invented the term student athlete to give the NCAA power to continue reaping benefits from these kids without having to provide compensation in return. So today's show will be dedicated to a discussion about the state of the student athlete as well as the current state of college sports. The sports program at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, or UMES for short, includes basketball, cross country, golf, tennis, and track for men and women, baseball for men, as well as bowling and softball for women, and the club soccer team, not to mention intramural sports. UMES is a member of the Mid-Eastern Atlantic Athletic Conference, also known as the MEAC. Mr. Keith Davison, the director of athletics, and two of the current student athletes from UMES have joined me today for this discussion. Before we get started, please note that the views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of 91.3 WESM or of the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. Mr. Davison, can you take a word just to tell us a little bit about your background and give us a one-minute overview of the purpose and goals of the athletic program at the university?
Hi, Dr. Wright. Pleasure to be here. I've been director of athletics at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore now for 12 years. I've been at the university for 15. I first came as the director of compliance, so I was kind of the police officer of the department, making sure we followed all the rules. I've been at athletics for over 20 years now. I first got involved in the early 90s as coordinator of student services, a position that was created when the NCAA really started to focus on the issues that were affecting student athletes off the fields of competition, drug, alcohol, male-female relationships, those types of things. And that's where I kind of got my feet wet in athletics, then moved on to compliance and had various positions within the athletic department. Came to the University of Maryland Eastern Shore in 2013. Followed my mentor here, Nelson Townsend, where I was able to be exposed to a wide variety of athletic disciplines. And I have been fortunate enough to continue my career here, and it's been my great pleasure to serve as athletic director here for the past 12 years.
Awesome. And as I said, we also have two of the current student athletes joining us as well. So I'm going to give you all a chance to just tell the audience who you are. Also, give us your name, your major, and the sport that you play.
Okay, my name is Janoy Brown. I major in criminal justice, and I do track and field.
Okay. My name is Taylor Claiborne. I'm majoring in mechanical engineering, and I play basketball here.
Okay. And what year are you guys?
I'm a freshman.
I'm a sophomore.
Okay. All right, cool. And what brought you all to UMES?
Basketball and the engineering program.
To be honest, I had friends who recommended me to come here, and I also wanted to do track here as well.
All right, so let's jump right into it with a very hot-button issue that we hear a lot about in the media today. In fact, this was discussed in the new HBO documentary film called Student Athlete. So my question is, should student athletes be paid? So I want to hear what the students think about that. Should you guys get paid?
Okay, well, there are two categories of student athletes. You have full and partial scholarship students, and you have walk-on student athletes. They're like different. Walk-ons just have no scholarship, so they don't have the same benefits of scholarship athletes. They have to buy their own books, get their own meal plan, and if they get injured, they have to like take care of that on their own. Okay. Yes, and a lot of schools and like athletic programs bring in a lot of money for schools, and it's hard to argue why they shouldn't get a little compensation.
Do you think that you should be compensated for what you do?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I don't want to get in trouble.
Taylor, how do you feel about that?
I feel the same as Janoy. I feel as though in some way, somehow, like, we are paid, like, through, like, room and board and, like, free meal plans and stuff like that. And I feel like that's their way of paying us to represent the school that we are playing for. And also to the kids sometimes, like, I feel as though they're not there for the money. Like, they're appreciative of that chance that they get to play and represent a school and play the thing that they love or run or, like, do the thing that they love. So I feel like, yes, Janoy is right in some sense, yes. But I feel like we still do get paid somehow, some way. Like, if it doesn't have to be, like, money in hand, but they find different ways to give back to us as we are representing the university.
So you're satisfied with the current situation?
Yes.
Okay. Let me throw out some information just for our audience. Back in 2014, college football players at Northwestern University petitioned the National Labor Relations Board to form a union. The NCAA disagreed with the petition, arguing that student athletes are not employees under federal law. But the Northwestern players countered the NCAA by stating these facts. Number one, they said the typical Division I college football player devotes about 43 hours per week to his sport, which is 3 hours more than a typical American work week. Two, the annual NCAA men's basketball tournament affects more than 6 days of classes. Three, at other schools, college coaches regulate student athlete speech on Facebook and Twitter, even when their sport is not in session. And four, the NCAA currently produces nearly $11 billion in annual revenue from college sports, more than the estimated total league revenues of both the National Basketball Association and the National Hockey League. So I want to take this question to Mr. Davidson. Number one, are you familiar with any colleges that up to this point have allowed for their students to unionize? And then also, what's your overall stance on this issue of paying college athletes?
Sure. First, I want to say, Janoy and Taylor, I don't want you guys to be scared or anything, all right? Nobody's going to get into trouble, all right? We encourage our student athletes to express themselves, and we want to create vehicles for them to express their opinions. And so we welcome that at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. I'm aware of the case at Northwestern. I found it an interesting approach to the whole idea of paying student athletes. Understand, not being a labor attorney, a lot of it went kind of over my head a little bit, and also to outside of my wheelhouse here at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. So whether students should be paid is a simple question that has a complex answer to it. My question back is that if we're going to pay student athletes, who gets paid? How much do they get paid? Do you get paid more if you're a starter or if you're not? What happens if you're not a starter? Ms. Taylor can tell you, in basketball, sometimes you start out as a starter and you wind up, you know, not starting. You know, the difference between revenue sports and non-revenue sports. Not everybody is the same. However, in our department, we seek to treat everyone fairly. And so there are some complex matrix as it relates to how you would pay somebody. Who should get paid. If you have a full scholarship athlete whose parents could otherwise send them to college free, should they be paid? Okay, so I think we should explore ways of being able to use NCAA revenues to help supplement student life on campus. I know the NCAA, particularly here at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, through our conference, provides funds for us to help student athletes as it relates to travel and emergencies and things like that. We offer funds to help students with a little bit of money to purchase coats or shoes or those types of things. Course supplies that go outside of the realm of the regular room, board, tuition fees, and books. And I think that the NCAA, I know, is looking at mechanisms in which to address the realities of young people who come to our universities, who come from backgrounds that don't allow them to have the same opportunities as other students, and also recognizing the commitment that they put into athletics prevents them from working and doing other things that might be able to help them financially. It's complicated. I know that the NCAA is looking at ways of using television revenue to provide universities money based upon their academic success, which they can use as they choose to accentuate the student athlete experience. And I think that's one way. And so I think it's probably a lot easier to try those approaches than trying to figure out how you issue a check to every student athlete.
Right. And you said a lot. So I just want to kind of like break down a few of those points. So you talked about, you know, students, you know, every sport's not created equally. Some students come from different situations. You know, I think about the fact that if you're talking about a university such as Alabama with their football program or the Dukes and Kentuckys in basketball, obviously those, you know, programs generate quite a bit of money in comparison to, let's say, a smaller sport at those particular colleges, right? Or if you play in a certain conference like the ACC, the Southeastern Conference, the SEC, compared to maybe our conference, the MEAC, you know, again, somebody might argue that, you know, those conferences bring in more revenue. And then there's this issue of the male sports versus the female sports and, you know, who's bringing in money. So, you know, again, it's like, do we pay everybody or are we only paying, you know, the basketball and football teams, but leaving out the track and the baseball? Are we only playing the men's programs versus the women? Well, is it the big schools versus the little schools?
I think it goes both ways. I mean, because we're really talking about conferences, too. Right. And you'll find that in certain sports, hockey is a revenue sport at certain institutions. At certain institutions, baseball is a revenue sport. Yeah. I would love to have the revenue that Connecticut's women's basketball team has. And I don't know the numbers, but I would think that the revenue that they generate rival the men, if not exceeds them. So I think it's relative. And I look at women's collegiate athletics and basketball. I look at programs like Notre Dame and Stanford and the revenues that they generate. I look at the NCAA tournament, Final Four in women's basketball. And I would imagine that is probably more popular than the WNBA. I think it's relative to the conference that you're in. And I think that's a reflection of the NCAA's new governance in terms of autonomy with the Power Five, giving those larger institutions the opportunity to craft mechanisms that affect them individually, that don't affect us here at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. One thing in particular is what has just passed recently, which allows schools to pay for travel of families of student athletes to championships. Now, that's something that we couldn't afford here at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. But if you're in a Power Five conference, you know, that's you know, something that you could probably do. And so there are over 350 some odd Division I institutions, and you can't use a one size fits all approach to governing all of those schools, particularly when they operate at two different ends of the athletic spectrum.
Mr. Davidson, I do have another question for you. So right now we're hearing a lot about this story in the news, the crisis over at the University of Maryland College Park, our flagship university, involving the death of their football player earlier this summer. And then you also had the resignation of the school's president and then the firing of the head football coach shortly after that. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that situation and how you think tragedies like that could be avoided in the future at all schools.
Well, first, my thoughts go out to the McNair family and their loss. That's everyone's worst nightmare in athletics. You know, as an athletic director, there's one thing I can guarantee is that there are going to be injuries, but you never think that you're going to lose a young person. It illuminates the importance of policies and procedures and protocols that have to be followed as it relates to the health and safety of student athletes. Policies, procedures, and protocols that go beyond just competing, you know, protecting young people off the court and sometimes protecting them from themselves. And so what it shows me is that, you know, bad things can happen. Those things aren't always reflections of a program, a person, an institution. However, how we respond to those and what we do in the aftermath can be a reflection. What I preach in our department and what I try to remind myself every day is in the decisions that we make with student athletes, we're going to always do what's in the best interest of the student athlete, not what's in the best interest of a coach, the athletic director, or maybe even the department. But we do what's in the best interest of the student athlete, because, and at the time, that may not be in the best interest of those other constituents. But after being involved in athletics for 20 years, I find that at the end of the day, if you do that, then ultimately you wind up doing what's best for everybody involved. And in absence of the student athlete, are we doing what's best for the family? And so I know a lot of the folks over at the University of Maryland. I know them to be good people. I will not in any way stand in judgment of them. Just as we talked earlier, we're not all the same, but we want to be treated fair. And there's how things operate there are differently than how they operate here as it relates to the breadth and scope of programs. But I would just kind of be reminded that those are the types of things that we try to focus on here at the University of Maryland in the aftermath of, or as it relates to any decision that we have to make in the aftermath of any issue that we face. Let's focus on what's in the best interest of the student athlete, i.e. The family. And I think what we see in the aftermath of this unfortunate death is questioning, you know, that decision. Was it in the best interest of the family? I was not involved in looking at the evidence of the case, and so I can't speak to the decisions that were made one way or the other. From my point of view, that's, you know, what we try to do here, and that's all I can speak about is at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore. And really, my heart goes out to them, because by the grace of God, there go I. And so I am aware of that, we could all find ourselves in that situation without any thought, word, or deed, or malice. And so that's important.
Once again, you are listening to UMES 30. My guests today are the University of Maryland Eastern Shore Athletic Director, Mr. Keith Davidson. And then we also have two of our student athletes, Ms. Taylor Claiborne, as well as Mr. Janoy Brown. So for the student athletes, in recent years, we've seen many athletes, Colin Kaepernick, LeBron James, Serena Williams, following the lead of Muhammad Ali, as well as John Carlos and Tommy Smith, by using their platforms to speak out on political as well as social issues of injustice. Back in 2015, you had student athletes at the University of Missouri from the football team who joined in a Black Lives Matter movement protest on campus and eventually led to the resignation of their president at the university. How do you all react when people say athletes should shut up and dribble and leave their political views off the playing field?
I think athletes has freedom of speech like any other person. And if we're like driven to say something, we shouldn't be scared just because like other people look up to us. And the passion in our like actions is influenced by like two things. It's whether we're being driven by preference or conviction. Like a conviction is not negotiable. One will to hold the conviction regardless of the cost. And passion is driven like by preference that gives you an option to do or not to do it. Muhammad Ali went to prison because it was his conviction that the war was immoral. And Colin Kaepernick is off the conviction that police brutality and other forms of discrimination is untenable. So I think we athletes should be able to talk.
Me personally, I feel the same as Janoy. I think us as athletes, we are like not the be all of the university, but we are addition to the university. Like we're in addition to bringing the name, like what it like stands for. Like we're bringing, what am I trying to say? Like we're bringing the name out of the school. I feel like if we do have something that we want to stand up for, I feel like we should be able to do so. We are not just athletes, but we are like American citizens of the United States. So I feel as though we do have freedom of speech, like Janoy said. I also think that it's a great platform, like using your sport as a way to connect with other people and put out certain political views that you believe should be recognized, and especially if they're negative, they're negative political situations. I feel as though this should be brought to light in certain circumstances, if that makes sense.
No, definitely. Now, would either of you be willing to stand up and speak out on a cause, especially at the end of the day, it could possibly risk you not just losing fans, but even, you know, maybe playing time or athletic scholarship?
Okay. I'm still evolving as a person. There are many issues that I have preferred position on. I'm not sure just yet that these have been elated to the point of conviction.
I got you. Taylor, what about you?
Yes, I have many like things I would stand up for, but there's always a certain time and place for it. Mm-hmm. If I do feel really strong about it, I'll find a way to do it, just not as out there. Like I'll be out there, but it won't be to a point where I'm overly accessing like, hey, this isn't right, so I'm gonna not do this. Not to a point where I could possibly lose my scholarship. Like I would rightfully know how to handle the situation, if anything.
Okay, good. Mr. Davidson, final question for you, sir, and I want to ask if you could try to give us your best response in about 30 to 40 seconds. So my question is, what do you say to critics who believe that HBCU sports no longer matter or have the same relevance that they used to 50 years ago, back when we had segregation?
First, I want to say how proud I am of these student athletes and their answers to your question. I would say that HBCU's athletics departments are still very relevant. They have faced the transition from desegregation like every aspect of society. I would say we're relevant, and the proof of that is just in our MEAC conference. If we weren't relevant, then our commissioner would not have been able to negotiate a Nike apparel deal for us. ESPN would not be televising our women's volleyball championship or bowling championship. The Celebration Bowl championship between the MEAC and the SWAC, having our men's and women's basketball games televised on TV. So I think the difference in HBCU athletics from 50 years ago are directly related to the options that young people have today, but is not in any way reflected of the interest and the importance that black college athletics still plays on our campuses, our colleges and campuses, and across the country.
Thank you. And on students, for a final question for you all. So I'm sure you all have very big goals on the playing field, but I want to know in the classroom, what's one major goal you have this year? And if you could just say it in about 20 seconds.
This year, just to try to get a 3 point and over GPA. Okay. Yeah, and pass your class.
For me, of course, like Janoy said, the GPA is my biggest thing. Just pushing for more. Also, just self-motivation, like keeping myself motivated and finding reasons on why I need to finish school or why I need to pass certain classes and why I need to get to where I want to go. Just remembering what my end-all, be-all is going to be at the end of the day and just to where I'm trying to get to. That
makes sense. All right, well, once again, I want to thank my guests for being here, Mr. Davison, as well as Taylor and Janoy. We end each show with my parting shots. This is when I give my thoughts on a topic in the news, pop culture, or in life that intrigues me. For this week's parting shots, I want to talk about my favorite sports team, the Washington Redskins. Being a Redskins fan today is difficult for several reasons. From a purely sports viewpoint, we've not gone to a Super Bowl since 1991. None of today's student guests were even alive at that time. But from a social standpoint, the Skins often find themselves on the wrong side of history. They were the last team in the NFL to integrate when they signed Bobby Mitchell in 1962. The Redskins were originally owned by George Preston Marshall, who was one of the strongest advocates for the color line in professional football. Fast forward to 2018, and we are debating the team's name and logo. While current owners say that it's to honor the Native Americans, this is more myth than reality. When one considers the team's history, it's hard to believe that the owners were truly concerned with honoring Native Americans in the 1960s when they were so instrumental in pushing the color line to bar all black players. We tend to overlook the plight of Native Americans in this country. The next time you get a free moment, Google President Andrew Jackson's 1830 Indian Removal Act and the Trail of Tears. And then let's see what you think about this Redskins name controversy. This is our show for the week. Thanks again to our guest. We do this every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. Like us on Facebook and social media. Special shout out to Uncle Phil and Aunt Viv. Have a blessed day.